to be taken with a grain of salt. I have noticed a lack of courage even among persons of superior intelligence and culture as to imparting strange psychological experiences. Almost all men are afraid that what their story might be suspected or laughed at. A truthful traveller saw an extraordinary creature such as a sea serpent, would have no fear of mentioning it, but the same traveller, having had some singular presentiment, vision, or dream, would hesitate considerably before he would admit it. In what I am going to relate, I have no intention of supporting any theory whatever. It does not matter how many years ago, or how few, a certain murder was committed in England, which attracted great attention. We hear more than enough of murderers today, and I would bury the memory of this particular brute if I could, as his body was buried in Newgate Jail. I purposely abstain from giving any direct clue to the criminal's identity. When the murder was first discovered, no suspicion fell on the man who was afterwards brought to trial. It is essential to remember the fact that no reference was made to him in the newspapers, and therefore no description of any kind appeared or drew my attention. Unfolding my paper one morning, I found the first account of that event to be deeply interesting, and I read it with close attention two or three times. The body had been discovered in a bedroom, and when I laid down the paper, I was aware of a flash, although no word I can find is satisfactorily descriptive, in which I saw that bedroom passing through my room like a picture impossibly painted on a running river. Though almost instantaneous in its passing, it was so clear that I distinctly, and with a sense of relief, observed the absence of the dead body from the bed. This curious sensation was entirely new to me. I was in chambers in Piccadilly, in my easy chair, and the vision was accompanied by a peculiar shiver which started the chair from its position. But I should note that the chair ran easily on castors. I went to one of the windows to refresh my eyes. It was a bright autumn morning, and the street was sparkling and cheerful. As I looked out, the wind whirled a quantity of fallen leaves into a spiral. As the leaves dispersed, I saw two men on the opposite side of the road, one behind the other. The foremost man looked back over his shoulder. The second man followed at some 30 paces, his right hand menacingly raised. At first, the steadiness of this threatening gesture in so public a place attracted my attention. Then the more remarkable fact that nobody heeded it. Both men threaded their way among the pedestrians with a smoothness unusual for walking on a pavement, and no one that I could see was aware of them. As they passed before my window, both men stared up at me. I saw their faces distinctly, and I knew that I could recognize them anywhere. The man who went first had an unusually lowering appearance, while the face of the man who followed was the colour of impure wax. In time, the details of the murder became better known by the general public, but I paid them little attention. I knew that at the inquest a verdict of wilful murder had been found against the suspected murderer, and that he had been committed for trial. I also knew that his trial had been postponed to give time for the preparation of the defence. I may further have known, although I believe I did not, the date when his postponed trial would come. I am a bachelor and I work in a bank. I wish that my duties as head of a department were as light as they are popularly supposed to be, but they kept me in town that autumn, when I stood in need of a change. I was not ill, but I was not well. I felt jaded, depressed by my monotonous life, and slightly dyspeptic, in the words of my doctor, a man of some renown. My sitting room, bedroom, and dressing room are all on one floor. With the last, there is no communication but through the bedroom. There is a door in it that once communicated with the staircase. For some years, my bath has been fixed across it and the door nailed up and covered. I was standing in my bedroom late one night, giving some directions to my servant before he went to bed. My face was towards the door to the dressing room, which was closed. My servant's back was towards that door. While speaking to him, I saw it open, and a man look in, who very earnestly beckoned to me. It was the second of the two men I had seen on Piccadilly, whose face was of the colour of impure wax. The figure, having beckoned, drew back and closed the door. With no longer pause than made by my crossing the bedroom, I opened the door to the dressing room and looked in, a lighted candle in my hand. I did not expect to see the figure, and there was no one there. Conscious that my servant stood amazed, I turned to him and said, "Derek, could you believe I fancied I saw?" As I laid my hand upon his breast, he trembled violently and said, "Oh Lord, yes, sir, a dead man beckoning." I do not believe that John Derrick, my trusty servant for more than 20 years, had any impression of seeing any figure until I touched him. The change in him was so startling that I fully believe he derived his impression in some occult manner from me at that instant. I bade him bring brandy, gave him a dram, and was glad to take one myself. Of what had preceded that night's phenomenon, I said not a word. I was absolutely certain I had never seen that face before, except that one occasion in Piccadilly. Comparing its expression at the door with that when it had stared up at my window, I came to the conclusion that first it had sought to fasten itself upon my memory, and now it had made sure of being remembered. I was not comfortable that night, although I felt certain that the figure would not return. At daylight, I fell into a heavy sleep from which I was awakened by Derek's coming to my bedside with a paper in his hand. It was a summons to me to serve on a jury at the forthcoming sessions at the Old Bailey. The appointed day was a raw morning in November. There was a dense brown fog in Piccadilly, and it became positively black and oppressive east of Temple Bar. I found the passages and staircases of the courthouse flaringly lighted with gas, and the court itself similarly illuminated. I took my seat in the place appropriated to jurors in waiting, and I looked about the court as well as I could through the cloud of fog that was heavy in it. I noticed the black vapour hanging like a murky curtain outside the great windows, the stifled sound of wheels on the straw littered in the street, and the hum of the people gathered there. Soon afterwards, the two judges entered and took their seats. The buzz in the court was hushed. The direction was given to put the murderer to the bar. He appeared there, and in that instant I recognized him as the first of the two men who had gone down Piccadilly. If my name had been called then, I doubt if I could have answered to it audibly. But it was called about 6th or 8th, and by that time I was able to say, "Here." As I stepped into the box, the prisoner, who had been looking on attentively but with no sign of concern, became violently agitated, and beckoned to his attorney. The prisoner's wish to challenge me was so manifest that it occasioned a pause, during which the attorney whispered with his client and shook his head. I afterwards heard it from that gentleman that the prisoner's first words to him were, "At all costs, challenge that man." But as he would give no reason, and admitted he had not known my name until he heard it called and I appeared, it was not done. Both because I wished to avoid reviving the unwholesome memory of that murderer, and because a detailed account of his long trial is unnecessary to my narrative, I shall confine myself to such incidents in the 10 days and nights of the trial which directly bear on my own personal experience. I was chosen foreman of the jury. On the second morning of the trial, happening to cast my eyes over my brother jurymen, I found an inexplicable difficulty in counting them. I counted them several times, yet always with the same difficulty. In short, I made them one too many. According to my count, we were always right in detail. There were 12 we could name, but in the gross we were always 13, one too many. I touched the brother juryman whose place was next to me, and I whispered to him, "Oblige me by counting us." He looked surprised by the request, but turned his head and counted. "Why," says he suddenly, "we are But no, it's not possible. No, we are 12. The jury were housed at the London Tavern. We slept in one large room on separate tables and were constantly in the charge of the officer sworn to hold us in safekeeping. He was intelligent, polite, and obliging, and much respected in the city. He had an agreeable presence, good eyes, enviable black whiskers, and a fine sonorous voice. His name was Mr. Harker. When we turned into our 12 beds at night, Mr. Harker's bed was drawn across the door. On the night of the second day, not being disposed to lie down, and seeing him sitting on his bed, I went and sat beside him and offered him a pinch of snuff. As his hand touched mine in taking it from my box, a peculiar shiver crossed him, and he said, "Who is this?" Following Mr. Harker's eyes along the room, I saw again the second of the two men in Piccadilly. I looked round at Mr. Harker. He was quite unconcerned, laughed, and said in a pleasant way, "I thought for a moment we had a 13th juryman, without a bed, but I see it is the moonlight." I watched what the figure did. It stood for a few moments by the bedside of each of my 11 brother jurymen. It seemed from the action of the head merely to look down pensively at each recumbent figure, but it took no notice of me or my bed, which was the one nearest to Mr. Harker's. It seemed to go out where the moonlight came in, through a high window, as if by a flight of stairs. Next morning at breakfast, it appeared that everybody present had dreamed of the murdered man, except myself and Mr. Harker. I was now convinced that the second man who had gone down Piccadilly was the murdered man, but the proof came in a manner for which I was not at all prepared. On the fifth day of the trial, a miniature of the murdered man, missing from his bedroom and afterwards found in a hiding place where the murderer had been seen digging, was put in evidence. It was handed first to the bench and then to the jury. As an officer in a black gown brought it to me, the second man in Piccadilly appeared, took the miniature from the officer and gave it to me with its own hands, saying in a hollow tone, "I was younger then, and my face was not then drained of blood." Each night when we were shut up together, we jurors had from the first discussed the day's proceedings. On that fifth day, the case for the prosecution being closed, our discussion was more animated and serious. Among our number was a vestryman, the densest idiot I have ever seen at large, who met the plainest evidence with the most preposterous objections. On each side of him sat two flabby parochial parasites, all the three who ought to have been at their own trial for countless offences. When these blockheads were at their loudest, towards midnight, while some of us were preparing for bread, I again saw the murdered man. He stood grimly behind them, beckoning to me. As I joined their conversation, he immediately retired. From then on, whenever a group of jurymen laid their heads together, I saw the murdered man among them. Whenever their comparison of notes went against him, he solemnly and irresistibly beckoned to me to join them. Remember that until to the appearance of the miniature on the fifth day of the trial, I had never seen the figure in court. Three changes occurred now that we entered on the case for the defence. First, the figure was in court continually, and looking not at me, but always at the person speaking at the time. For instance, in the opening speech for the defence, it was suggested that the deceased might have cut his own throat. At that very moment, the figure stood at the speaker's elbow, motioning across its windpipe, vigorously suggesting the impossibility of such a wound having been self-inflicted. Secondly, as a character witness, a woman deposed to the prisoner as being the most amiable man. The figure stood on the floor before her and pointed out the prisoner's evil countenance with an extended arm and an outstretched finger. The third change impressed me strongly, although the figure was not itself perceived by those it addressed. Its coming close to such persons was invariably attended by some disturbance on their part. It seemed as if it were prevented by some unknown law from fully revealing itself to others, and yet it still could somehow overshadow their minds. When the counsel for the defence suggested suicide and the figure stood at his elbow, frightfully sawing at its severed throat, it is undeniable that the counsel faltered, lost thread of his discourse, and turned extremely pale. When figure stood by the character witness, her eyes followed the direction of its pointed finger and rested in great hesitation and trouble on the prisoner's face. Two additional illustrations will suffice. On the eighth day of the trial, in the early afternoon, I came back into court with the rest of the jury before the return of the judges. Looking about me, I thought the figure was not there, until, raising my eyes to the gallery, I saw it leaning over a very decent woman, as if to assure itself whether the judges had resumed their seats or not. Immediately afterwards, that woman screamed, fainted, and was carried out. And with the venerable, sagacious, and patient judge who conducted the trial, when the case was over and he settled himself to sum up, the murdered man advanced to his lordship's desk and looked eagerly over his shoulder at his notes. A change came over his lordship's face, the peculiar shiver that I knew so well passed over him. He faltered, "Excuse me, gentlemen, for a few moments. I am somewhat oppressed by the air," and did not recover until he had drunk a glass of water. Through all the monotony of those days, the same judges and others on the bench, the same murderer in the dock, the same lawyers at the table, the questions and answers rising to the roof of the court, the same scratching of the judge's pen, the same ushers going in and out, the same lights kindled at the same hour, the same dark curtain outside the windows when it was foggy, the same water dripping when it was rainy, the same footmarks of turnkeys and prisoner on the same sawdust, the same keys locking and unlocking the same heavy doors. Through all the wearisome monotony which made me feel as if I had been foreman of the jury for a vast period of time and Piccadilly had flourished in the same past as Babylon, the murdered man remained as distinct as all those around him. Meanwhile, I must not omit that I never once saw the murdered man look toward the murderer. Again and again I wondered, why does he not? But he never did. Nor did he look at me after the production of the miniature until the last closing minutes of the trial. We, the jury, retired to consider our verdict at 7 minutes to 10 at night. The idiotic vestryman and his companions gave us so much trouble that we twice returned to court to beg to have certain extracts from the judge's notes reread. 9 of us had not the smallest doubt about these passages. The dunderheaded triumvirate, however, disputed them for that very reason. At length we prevailed, and finally the jury returned into court at 12:10. The murdered man stood on the other side of the court, directly opposite the jury box. As I took my place, his eyes rested on me. With great attention he seemed satisfied, and slowly shook a great grey veil over his head and whole form. As I gave in our verdict, guilty, the veil collapsed. All was gone, and his place was empty. The murderer, being asked by the judge whether he had anything to say before sentence of death should be passed, muttered something described in the leading newspapers of the following day as a few rambling, incoherent words in which he complained that he had not had a fair trial because the foreman of the jury was prejudiced against him. The remarkable declaration that he really made was, "My lord, I knew I was a doomed man when the foreman of my jury came into the box. I knew he would never let me off because, before I was arrested, he somehow got to my bedside in the night, woke me, and put a rope round my neck." That was To Be Taken with a Grain of Salt by Charles Dickens, abridged by Martin Foreman, read by Alistair Wales.
Arbury, drama and fiction. Hear more drama and fiction, old and new, on arburyproductions.co.uk.